thanks so much.
Yeah, because this is a very personal book that I'm reading at the moment. It is a shocking account of a loss of a young girl's innocence.
Yes, but really I'd like to see that the book is more than that. I mean, it's the story of recovery as well, and it's the story of moving past abuse, past survival, and learning how to live well in the future.
You were subjected to sexual abuse from your father from the age of four, and yet from reading this book, your so-called orderly world turned upside down at the age of 43. Explain that.
Yes, well, I'd actually repressed all memories of what happened to me, and what happened, as is often the case, was that a life event triggered the memories, and my niece was actually killed tragically in a car accident, and that started the process of unlocking memories which really had not been available to my conscious mind. I actually had no memory for about 10 years of my childhood, which is really very...
Were you aware of this prior to your niece's death, that you had lost 10 years of your life?
I was certainly aware that when people reminisced about their childhood, that I couldn't say anything, and that used to really irritate and aggravate me. But I dismissed it. I put it to the back of my mind. I just rationalised that I had a poor memory, and that was that. I didn't explore it.
You didn't make things up about what a lovely time it was when you were age 7 or 8 or anything.
Well,
I'd
been, you know, given a script for my life by my mother, which was, you know, you had a wonderful childhood and everything was happy, but that was really as far as I could go. I could repeat that, but if anyone asked me any detail, there was nothing to offer.
It's extraordinary. It's a powerful thing, this mind, isn't it?
Yes, it is, absolutely.
So what happened following the death of your niece? You went through the normal process, I suppose, and the family grieving and the funeral. So when was it that you got your first, well, what do I call them, a flashback?
Yes, look, I mean, I obviously was grieving very heavily because I was very close to Angela, but as were my other family members, but as their grief, if you like, started to improve, I became progressively more anxious and started to develop panic attacks and really sank into a very severe depression.
Were you a practicing GP by this time?
Yes, I was a practicing GP at that time, and over several months it became obvious that I really wasn't well enough to practice, and so I took a leave of absence, but actually never went back, because this process of dealing with what came up about my past really subsumed me for many years. And so initially I started to recall memories of my father's death, and he'd died quite suddenly when I was 14. And so the parallel there was two sudden deaths. And as I started to remember about him, because that was a death that I hadn't grieved at the time, really, so other memories and then, you know, very, very nasty flashbacks started to come back.
Yeah, well, as we said, it started at the age of four, and then it sort of intensified by the time you were 9 when he was actually raping you?
Yes, that's right.
Can you describe, well, see, if you have repressed memory, I suppose, are you able to describe the feelings you had for your father in those years?
Yes, look, it's very complicated because my mother is a Holocaust survivor, and, you know, as a result of that and obviously, you know, horrific experiences in that genocide, she suffered enormously and was not able to be emotionally available to me, and hence, in a way, enabled what went on with my father, because she, after her experiences in the war, really developed a mental script that everything would be fine no matter what, and so she had this fantasy of our wonderful life, despite the reality of what was actually going on. Now, my father was actually initially my primary nurturer. He was able to love and care for me, but of course then that love became quite abnormal when he crossed boundaries. And so, you know, I idealise my father because he was the one who did love and care for me initially, and my mother sadly couldn't.
That was where you were getting the love and care that a child looks for at that age.
That's
you were
right.
Getting from him, therefore. But some of the things that he was doing to you, interfering with you personally,
yes,
did it set off any alarm bells even within your young mind then?
No, look, obviously it was very, very hard to relate you know, someone who loves and cares for you, but is also, you know, horrifically hurting you.
Mm.
And, you know, this has been studied, of course, and it's called betrayal trauma, and it's a double bind for a child when their primary carer and nurturer is actually abusing them. And of course, what the child does then is put all of that to another space in their mind and cut off from the actual hurt. And that's what I did. I compartmentalised a lot of those memories so that they remained really separate from one another and not accessible to my conscious mind.
So you didn't discuss this even in innocent terms with your friends, your school colleagues, etc.?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, when a child is abused and terrorised, there's a lot of shame. The child takes on a very inappropriate sense of shame and self-blame.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I almost lived a double life, you know. I went to school and, of course, I was very, very good because I was scared of being noticed and made attention of. And so I was very shy and retiring and not noticed.
But you were carrying this load with you each day you went to school.
Absolutely. But to a degree, I suspect that I'd already cut off from it. So this process of dissociation or compartmentalisation was actually already protecting my psyche. I mean, it's hard to know, you know, how soon that started or exactly what went on. But I think that, you know, my school persona was very different to my home persona.
You were 14 when he died. How old were you when it all stopped?
Look, it came and went. Look, it's very hard with trauma because the nature of traumatic memory is that it's stored often without a time sequence.
Yeah. I guess what I'm getting at was he continuing interfering with you up until his death?
On and off.
Yeah.
On and off, yes.
Yeah. Did this affect the way in which you socialised? Did you have a boyfriend?
I certainly didn't have a boyfriend at that time. Mm. I was really quite withdrawn. I had a few friends, not many, and certainly our family was very isolated. We had very few social connections.
Yeah. Well, I guess that could have... That would have been a good thing for you because it was easy for you then to keep quiet about a few things.
Yes, but I suppose it also enabled the abuse to continue because when there are very few people coming and going from a home, it helps to maintain the secrecy and the silence.
Well, did you say, don't do that, Dad? I don't like it at any time.
Look, it was very complicated because my father, as I say, I was very attached to him. I idealised him and he was actually mentally ill. And I believed at some point that he was dying and that I needed to do whatever I could to keep him alive. And if this was what made him happy, then that's, in my child's mind, what I was going to do. Of course, it was all, you know, very sick and abnormal. But you know, I was a child and he was my one nurturing parent.
How do you feel now at the age you are now and going through the trauma, I would imagine, of writing this book?
Yeah, look, I mean, the trauma, of course, was as a child, but again, there's been 10 years of trauma in coming to terms with it and with integrating it, so finding all those parts of myself that were separated and putting them together into a whole. So, look, I understand both my mother and my father, but of course, every child deserves to be nurtured and protected, and I certainly wasn't.
But did you, my point is, Kathy, did you say to him, I don't like what you're doing, it hurts?
Well, I cried and he got very distressed, but as I said, I was very worried about him and I saw that this is what he wanted to do and so I just continued to listen.
Did he, and I seem to be almost defending the defenceless here, but did he have a normal sexual life with your mother?
Look, I mean, obviously as a child I didn't know that, but my mother's since told me that he was very disinterested in sex, but, you know, it's hard for me to...
Yeah, but I guess my point is, and I'm not an analyst, by any means, I don't, forgive me for sounding that way, but I'm just wondering, was he pursuing his sexual pursuits with you rather than with his wife?
From what I've read and understand, I mean, sexual abuse is not about, you know, normal sexual gratification. You know, it's about control and seeking it inappropriately. So it's not because adults aren't getting the sex elsewhere. It's a very abnormal practice.
Yes. Now, you mentioned your mum's past and as a Jew in Warsaw.
Yes.
Why have you included that? Because that really takes up a fair bit of the beginning of the book. What was that to justify in some way your mum was?
Well, I mean, my process of writing this book was about trying to understand. And so trying to understand a mother who didn't protect me despite all of these things going on. And so I sought to understand her past and see what happened to her as part of that explanation. Yes.
Okay, so your mum is still alive.
Yes, she is.
And is this discussed?
No, look, I mean, I've approached her over the years to talk about all the things that I've remembered in my book, and she, you know, certainly doesn't acknowledge anything. Very genuinely, I believe, says that she doesn't remember them.
Well, how does she feel about you bringing this book out?
It's quite complicated because she has said that she's not troubled by it, but initially, I mean, she was obviously quite upset about it. But we've come to a point where she accepts that these are my memories and my story, and her story is different. And I mean, that's how it is. I mean, sadly, you know, we don't see each other at this point. We communicate by email, but that's how it is.
You have siblings?
Yes, I've got one brother.
And what his feeling towards what you've done now, what you've put in print, and what were his memories?
Yeah, look, he also hasn't validated my memories. He also denies the fact that this happened, but I am aware that my brother also really has very, very little detail about the memories of his childhood. And
belief
about him is that he's dissociated these memories just as I had.
Has he refused to believe this? And yes. Has he said to you that this is rubbish?
Yes, he has. Yes, he has. But I'm quite sure that, you know, this is my story as I've written in the book. Obviously, it's hard to corroborate these memories, but the process of recovering these traumatic memories, the 10 years of horror that I've withstood, and the way I've changed as a result of developing a personal narrative of my life, really makes a lot of sense. And the fact that I had no memory for 10 years of my childhood, to those in the, you know, psychology area, that's a red flag that someone has suffered really substantial trauma.
Yeah, because there are some question marks put over
recovered memory.
Well,
certainly in the 1990s there was a lot of discussion about recovered memories, but there's been a lot of studies since. And certainly the evidence is very solid that people can certainly recover memories of childhood abuse many years later, and that those memories are valid. False memories can also occur, but it's believed that they only occur of the order of 1-5%. So the study has moved on, and it's also been found that the validity of recovered memories is actually the same as the validity of the memories that people have always retained. So, yes, there was controversy, but it's much more accepted now by the clinical world that dissociative amnesia, which I believe is what I've suffered, is the basis for that memory loss, and that many of them are valid.